Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Under the Fifth Amendment, an accused person has a right to remain silent, but applying that right is a lot of times more difficult than it appears. Depending on where you live, there are questions about how you invoke that right to remain silent and if you have to say explicitly that that's what you're doing. Here's Rebecca Livingood. She's an attorney with the ACLU in New Jersey.
By and large, people who are questioned by the police are not experts in constitutional law. They don't know the exact words that courts have recognized in the past. And so where they make an attempt to invoke their Fifth Amendment right, a core protection that the Constitution provides all of us, the police officers who are trained in constitutional law have the burden of clarifying whether they, in fact, are invoking.
Your right to remain silent is the subject of this week's case in point from the Marshall Project. The case involves a dad that we're referring to by his initials, SS, in New Jersey. SS was accused of molesting his 4-year-old daughter, and during the interrogation, he repeatedly made comments that his lawyers say were ambiguously invoking his right to remain silent. WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez sat down with Rebecca Livingood and with Andrew Cohen, author of Case in Point, to talk about the case.
Obviously, the facts that are alleged are horrible. It's hard to imagine a worse crime. And yet you have this conflict that is a conflict in the law that could come to all of us at a certain point. You have a suspect. He's in an interrogation room. It's sort of a series of questions asked by the police about his daughter and why would she make up this story and that sort of thing. At first he says, no, that's all I got to say. That's it. And the police keep questioning him. And then he says, I don't know. That's all I can say. And then there's a bit of a break. And then the police come back and they ask him, is there anything that you thought about, anything you want to tell us? And he responds, no. Now, one interpretation of his responses is that he was invoking his constitutional right to remain silent. And if that were the case, the police had an obligation either to ask him to clarify exactly what he was trying to do, whether he was trying to invoke his right, or to simply stop the questioning and not go any further and allow him to perhaps get a lawyer or just to move on. That didn't happen in this case. The police continued to question him, and eventually he broke. He made a series of incriminating statements that prosecutors then used to convict him at a trial. Afterward, on appeal, the issue of the statement came up. It's now before the New Jersey Supreme Court. As we speak, they're contemplating what to do with this case. And obviously, there's a lot at stake.
So the issue here is that the father said no over and over. And the question is it by saying no, is he denying the allegations or is he sort of expressing his desire to remain silent? Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
How specific do you need to be when you say no during an interrogation? Now, the federal law is not as broad as the New Jersey law. You have to clearly and unambiguously invoke your right to remain silent in the federal system and in the system of other states. New Jersey sort of gives you a break if you're a suspect. You can ambiguously invoke your right to remain silent, at which point the cops basically have to sort of draw it out with you to figure out what you want to do. The other issue that I found fascinating and where Rebecca comes in is that one of the arguments now being asserted in the case is that the tone of the way in which SS made his statements is being used by prosecutors, being used by the appellate courts to say he didn't really mean to invoke his rights. His tone was so flat, it was so unaffected, it was so calm, if you will, that surely he wasn't exercising his constitutional rights to remain silent. And one of the arguments the ACLU is making is that there is a racial component to this, that young black men are sort of conditioned to be very calm around the police, to try to not be assertive in any way, and that shouldn't be used against SS in this situation.
SS, the father, is not necessarily a sympathetic character. His daughter, then 4 years old, said that her dad did this. So why is the fact that he's not such a sympathetic character important?
So there are 3 reasons that I would say that the fact that he's not sympathetic doesn't really carry any weight in the disposition of this case. The first is that the question before the court is about whether he invoked his right to silence. And that invocation question is about what happened in the interrogation room, what he said to police, and then what police said to him. It has nothing to do with what happened before he entered the interrogation.
Okay.
The second reason is that the even-handed administration of those determinations of constitutional law requires that courts look not at overall, is this defendant a sympathetic figure? Overall, do we think that what he did is okay? But what did he say in the room and what did the police say? And that is the only way that constitutional law applies equally to all of us, is if courts are confining their inquiry to that conversation.
Right. You don't get to pick and choose who gets constitutional rights.
Exactly.
Okay. And the third?
And the third is that this decision will last beyond this case. So the New Jersey Supreme Court is deciding what police officers have to do when a defendant says in an even tone, that's all I've got to say. And that going forward will affect the conduct of police officers when dealing with very sympathetic suspects, when dealing with not very sympathetic suspects. And so the creation of the law that's taking place here can't be based on the fact that this defendant was unsympathetic.
There's also a race component here that Andrew has touched on a couple of times. Rebecca, what role does race play here?
So this was our biggest concern with the appellate division's decision. What the appellate division said was, on paper, what he said appears to be ambiguous and would have triggered this obligation by the police. But in fact, when we look at his tone, he's speaking in a calm voice. He has a very level, even demeanor. And so he didn't mean that he was invoking his right to silence. He just meant he didn't want to talk about the accusation. He could keep talking to them about whatever else they wanted to talk about. And our concern is that SS lives in a world, as we all do, where black men face disproportionate violence by police and the threat of violence. And when we have President Obama, former Attorney General Eric Holder, who was at the time the chief law enforcement officer in the country, saying that he had to have the talk with his son about speaking to the police in calm, even tones, and recognizing that families around the country have those talks with their sons. To then say when a young black man uses calm even tones that he's not invoking his constitutional rights, using identical language to language the court has found to be an invocation when other suspects have said it, raises serious equal protection concerns.
And so what is the status of this case and next steps?
So the case was argued at the New Jersey Supreme Court in February, and the New Jersey Supreme Court will make a determination. The questions before it are the level of deference that reviewing courts owe trial courts determinations based on the video, and the role of tone in assessing whether a defendant has invoked.
That was attorney Rebecca Livingood with the ACLU in New Jersey and Andrew Cohen of the Marshall Project speaking with WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez.